This is the Creative Agency Podcast,
where we explore the strategies,
aspirations,
methods, and mistakes
behind growing and maintaining
a successful
creative agency.
Hello, and welcome to another ear-tingling, knowledge-enhancing, wisdom-producing episode of the Creative Agency Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Bolton. Today, we ask the age-old question, how does one go from earning a PhD in poetry to running a successful coding agency? Well, it just so happens, Zach Davis of Cast Iron Coding is the man to ask. Zach has used his background in English and writing to enhance his abilities as a creative and business owner. This has especially helped in his proposal writing. You don't need to be a coder to appreciate the valuable insights that Zach shares in this interview, so stay tuned. If you like the show, I'd love to see your 5-star reviews in iTunes. It makes me glow inside. If you have any questions or comments, please be sure to visit creativeagencypodcast.com and drop me a line. Now let's get to that interview. All right, I am here with Zach Davis, co-founder of Cast Iron Coding, a development agency which just so happens to also exist in our building. Welcome, Zach.
Thanks, Chris.
You're actually the second agency owner that I've interviewed who's also located in the Washington High School building. I feel like no agency is really safe in this building from this podcast, so I'll eventually get them all.
You have lots to choose from.
I know. Eventually, I'll move on from this building and on to other pastures.
But sure.
It's easy to get people down here.
Yeah, yeah.
Captive audience. So Cast Iron Coding is a coding agency, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. We kind of try to bridge the gap a little bit between coding and design, I think. But I think engineering is kind of fundamentally in our DNA in the way that like branding might be in another agency. Mm-hmm.
And how long has Cast Iron Coding been around?
We've been at it since 2012 or 2002, so it's been about 13 years now.
Wow. How many employees do you have?
We have 10 full-timers in our office, and then we have a couple subcontractors here in town that, mm-hmm. for all practical purposes, are working as much as full-time employees.
You actually have an interesting educational background. You have a PhD in English and specifically 17th century poetry.
That's right.
Yeah. Is that how you get into coding?
Yeah. That was, I don't want to say an early misstep career-wise, because I don't have a lot of regret. I have a lot of debt, but not a lot of regret, right, about it. I did get my start in English literature and teaching, you know, kind of transitioned into development while I was doing that.
I was actually an English literature major myself as well.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I mean, it's helped me immeasurably in this line of work, and maybe that's something we can talk about at some point during this conversation. But being able to communicate clearly and approach things in a kind of analytical way and think in terms of rhetoric and argument, even as a developer, has been, mm-hmm. hugely helpful.
That's great. What were the early days of Cast Iron Coding like?
So the earliest days were when I was in New York and Lucas, my partner, was here in Portland. And I kind of thought, well, you know, this teaching gig isn't really paying the bills. So I started up Cast Iron Coding as almost a side project to get me through writing my dissertation. And it pretty quickly became the main project. And, you know, all my writing became secondary. After the first, I think, year, I moved out here to Portland. My daughter was one at the time, and New York seemed unnecessarily challenging in terms of lifestyle.
Yeah.
So we made the trek to Portland, you know, ran it out of the basement for maybe another year or two after that, and then hired our first employee, and then moved into the Olympic Mills building.
Nice. So in the beginning, were you making ends meet when it was just you and your partner?
Yeah, but like, you know, what it meant to make ends meet at that point, right, was a lot different than it is now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think so. I mean, I had been living on so little as an adjunct professor in New York. It didn't take very much to feel like an increase in my lifestyle.
Yeah, I hear you.
But yeah, it was, you know, there were the kinds of challenges that you have in an early stage agency in terms of developing like a pretty constant flow of work. That was exciting in the early days.
Did you have trouble finding clients early on?
We did. I mean, we had an interesting spot that we were in. When I started the agency with this idea that we were going to provide services around this one open source content management system that nobody's ever heard of called Typo3. And the reason I wanted to do that was because I had built out this Typo3 site for this organization, the City University of New York system. And so I knew it, and I thought this is a pretty powerful open source tool. I think we could build, you know, pretty big stuff with it. So initially, we throw our site up and we start advertising a little bit around this. And I'm kind of involved in the Typo3 community, which, as it turned out, was kind of primarily located in Denmark and Germany.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so all of our early clients were American subsidiaries of German companies, where the parent company mandated that they use this one German system. Yeah. And so early on, we got pretty good jobs because we were the only people, I mean, not the only ones, but one of two or three small teams in the US that could work with this system. That gave us a huge kind of step up in the beginning because the market was so small. It later proved to be a really limiting factor. And if we talk about things I would do differently, I have some thoughts about how I would have proceeded differently in that regard. But it kind of gave us a boost to have a really small focus market that we were in.
So I guess that leads us right into if you, looking back now, what would you have done sort of differently?
I mean, this is, I think, something that all agency owners probably come up against at some point. You find a small market or a small corner of the market that works well for you, and it can be quite profitable, but it can also be very limiting and hard to escape from. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's we do Typo3 sites, or we do restaurant sites, or we do whatever that is, it's hard to get out of it. And it's, you get in this reinforcing cycle where those kinds of jobs lead to more of those kinds of jobs. So what I would have done differently in the beginning was just move more quickly in terms of building on that success and translating into something else. I've done this kind of site. How can I take this to a different kind of client and kind of expand what we're able to do? Because as it happened, 12 years ago, at the time it was unclear. Is it going to be Drupal? Is it going to be Joomla? Is it going to be Typo3? Is it going to be WordPress? Who's going to win this battle? And of course, in the end, it really was WordPress, with Drupal also being important in a smaller market. Typo3 and Joomla just kind of faded away. And so there was a period in there where we had to transition away from that. And that was, would have been easier if we'd done it sooner, I think.
That's interesting. Yeah. And the first interview I did with Needmore, they started out doing Flash websites.
Yeah. Yeah.
They talked about sort of talking to their clients even when they knew it was coming and being like, guys, I know that we make really cool Flash websites, but it's going to go away.
Right. Right. Yeah. And that's a mistake that I don't think I'd make again. And some of it was just from being kind of inexperienced in the business and not having a full read on how quickly things change and how kind of Darwinian this world is, especially on the engineering side.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever worry about that happening again, or do you feel like you sort of have a wide breadth of capabilities now?
Yeah, I don't worry about it now. And mainly that's because we had all this stuff built up around Typo3, and we were really comfortable making those sites, and we had tooling and processes in place. And so the first time we're like, well, let's try to do something totally different. That was hard because you don't know, am I going to eat it on this project? Is it going to go way over budget? What's going to happen? But the second time it's a little easier, the third time it's a little easier. And now, we do it on every project. Every project, it's like, well, what's out there? And not just in terms of what CMS or what platform we're going to use, but what language are we going to use? Are we going to use an object-oriented approach or a more functional style in terms of how we write code? And just over time, embracing that and having our culture be one in which we're kind of changing and trying something new on every project, I think really mitigates the fear that comes with doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know if we're pretty tied into WordPress right now, it's where we build all our websites. I know if something else came along and sort of kicked WordPress to the curb, we'd have to scramble a bit to get on board with the other
And WordPress is kind of an interesting case, I think, because it has such a huge market share. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you look at like some of the places where we do our work, like Rails, or, you know, nowadays maybe we'll do like an Angular or a React project. But like relative to the market share of WordPress, these are still really small pieces. So I don't know. It's WordPress is kind of tied up with that whole PHP story of where it just dominates this massive part of the industry for better and for worse, I think.
So how is Cast Iron going now?
It's going well. We have a new set of challenges now.
Yeah.
I mean, as you no doubt know, that's kind of that's what you're signing up for, I think, when you run an agency, is just like, okay, we got to 3 people and now there's new problems. And then we got to 5 and then 10, and I imagine it just keeps going. Yeah, so business is good. There's a pretty constant stream of work and you know, leads come in, and I feel like I have a really good team right now. So I can't complain on that front, but there are kind of like constant difficulties around scheduling and like trying to keep enough free capacity to take on new opportunities when they come in, but mm-hmm. not to have so much where you're not bringing in enough revenue on a monthly basis.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the freelance people come in. And mm-hmm. is that sort of a resource that you always want to have available because of that sort of scalability?
Yeah, it is. Although, you know, we almost never bring in contractors or freelancers for development. It's almost always for design. And so usually, like, and that's who we have now. We have UX designers and visual designers that we work with. It's really hard for me to imagine bringing in like a one-off engineer freelancer because mm-hmm. of kind of how involved our processes are, and in terms of like our development process is like at the heart of everything we do, and it takes months to get people kind of up to speed on that.
Right.
So we do end up turning down jobs I tend to be very conservative around growth too. The culture, like what it's like to be at Cast Iron Coding. Do I enjoy going to work there every day? Those are things that are so important to me. And I feel like you grow too quickly, you bring too many people on, you take too many risks, it can kind of endanger that. And so I'm very conservative with that side of the business.
I feel like I haven't interviewed a ton of people, but there seems to be a growing theme of when an agency gets to the 10 plus range of people, that there's a real sort of tipping point and it can get really sort of chaotic. I think Patrick was saying getting from 10 to 20 people was really where things got really kind of crazy at Copious.
Yeah, and, I can imagine.
Yeah, you have to start dialing in a lot more things and considering a lot more options as you grow, and a lot of processes, got to outline a lot of things and make sure it can't just be all in your head anymore.
yeah. And you have to let go of a lot of stuff. That's the hard thing to do as an owner. You know, that it's kind of a cliche, right, in business that like the owner's job is to somehow make themselves not necessary to the operation mm-hmm. of the business. But that I'm finding that to be true in some ways, and very, very difficult, like very hard to step back and delegate certain things to people, even people who I think very highly of their work and trust.
So how would you describe your specialty now?
That probably depends on who you ask at Cast Iron Coding. You know, I'll talk about it, I guess, in terms of the company I see Cast Iron Coding becoming over time. Mm. You know, I see us as I see our kind of sweet spot right now as being in functional, like product work. That's at least what I want to be doing most of the time. That's not to say that we don't build informational or even transactional websites for clients and for marketing groups. We do that, and that's a lot of our revenue comes from that. But the place where I'm really interested in, and I think we do really great work in, is when you know, we're helping a client write software, usually on the web, that solves a fairly complex problem. Mm-hmm. And that we're like in the room and having conversations about the problem domain and coming up with solutions at a kind of high architectural level, and then, you know, implementing those all the way down into code. That's where I like us to be. Mm-hmm. It's not where we started. So it's been a slow transition into that over time. And there are many people on my team, I think, who are still in some ways more comfortable working you know, just on like a more traditional web development side of things. And I think we'll stay in that realm too for at least the foreseeable future.
Okay, cool. So I've heard tell that you're pretty good at writing proposals.
Well versed in it. Not...
You do have that literary background.
Yeah.
So I figured it'd be good to talk a little bit about proposals. I'm sure that your proposals are probably a bit more technical than ours, and that has its own set of unique challenges. I guess the first question I'll ask you is, what do you think makes a good proposal?
In my mind, it's two things. It has to come off as confident and detailed. So, you know, I see a lot of proposals that people write that are very surfacey. And I think a lot of the time that's because the brief or the RFP that you get is poorly written or vague or whatever, just a wish list and not something that you can really engage or act on. I mean, often what I'll do is I'll kind of sidestep the brief if it's not good, look at the problem and try to like sketch out a well thought out, detailed, high level, but detailed solution. That's always my strategy, you know, like sit down. If I were really going to build this and I had 2-3 hours to spend thinking about it, what shape would it take? What software would I say they should use? What language? Mm-hmm. Why? And then try to go in really deep with that. Not necessarily technical, because I don't want to, my goal is not to snow my audience, or, you know, which I think you get a lot with engineering. Like, some engineers will take advantage of the fact that their audience or their reader isn't really speaking the same language right. They are, and that people sense that and it turns them off immediately. But if you can, you know, say, I'm confident, I have a really good solution, I've engaged your problem, I think it could be solved in this way, I find clients really respond well to that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And it's all long, like everything. I mean, this is maybe a bad side effect of my educational background, but whenever I write a proposal, it's, you know, 15 pages longer than it should be, which is, it just comes out that way. And some clients, like, it's not for every client, you know. Yeah. You'll get like some enterprise-y kind of client where they want to talk fast. They don't have a lot of time. They don't write complete sentences in their emails, and they get my proposal and they're like, oh, I don't have time to read this book, you know, and it's just probably not a good fit for us. But some really respond well to it.
How many proposals do you usually write, like a month?
It's slowed down. I mean, never a lot. I probably put together, I don't know, 3 to 5 good ones a month. Lots of stuff comes across my desk and I just don't even, you know, you get that stuff. It's like, I want to build something like Facebook or whatever. Right. And you just throw it away. But when I see something where there's some evidence that some thought went into it on the client side, or it's real, or there's a budget allocated for it, then I'll usually put together a proposal. And yeah, it usually ends out like a handful a month, I think.
Do most come in the form of an RFP, or?
Not most of the ones we get.
Yeah.
I'll typically only respond to an RFP if I have a prior relationship with the client, mm-hmm. or if they were referred to us by somebody, you know, if there's some kind of connection there.
Right.
The ones that just come in out of nowhere are typically not winners in my experience.
Yeah. Yeah. We struggle with RFPs too, because they're a ton of work and it's hard to know, did they send this out to 100 people right. or 5 people?
And... Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
How much research kind of goes into a proposal? You're sort of saying like 2 or 3 hours might go into writing a proposal, but like how much do you deem sort of worthy in proposal writing of sort of...
That's a good question. So much of that depends on what I know coming in, right? Or what they've communicated in the RFP. If it's a project we've done before, and at this point a lot of them are that, mm-hmm. Like a redesign of an existing site, and, you know, maybe they have complex content workflow requirements or multiple languages or versioning, whatever. Usually I kind of already have ideas about how we solve those problems. And so it's a matter of pulling from that and putting it together. If it's a new problem and one that's engaging, then I can get, like, sometimes I'll get lost in it for days. It yeah. becomes an opportunity to be like, oh, well, this is an interesting problem. What tool is out there that I don't know about to solve it? And maybe I can spend half a day messing around with it. That's mm-hmm. kind of the fun part of the job. So it really depends on the project. You know, I'm probably not a great salesman in the sense that I don't spend a lot of time like researching the client, or I'm not much of like one to court my prospective clients. Mm-hmm. I'm not a whiner and diner. Yeah, I like to think about the problem, and sometimes that I can get lost in that a little bit.
What do you think makes a client, sort of given what you just said, choose you, maybe based on a proposal?
I think it's always clarity of communication and depth mm-hmm. of thought. You know, I think clients, especially when it's an RFP and especially when they've contacted 10 different agencies or whatever, I think it's really apparent to them which responses are mostly canned. Just here's what we do. Here's our boilerplate. Even if it's wrong, even if it's like the vendor engaged the problem and thought about it and got it totally wrong, I think they see the evidence of thought and really mm-hmm. value it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you, what do you use to write your proposals? Do you have a proposal software? Or is it?
It's low tech. No, we don't. I often wonder if we need that, but it's really just like a pages template and then text, paragraphs of text that we come up with.
We just started using Proposify mainly because we were writing everything in, or everything was designed by our designers in Illustrator. And now that non-designers are trying to send out the proposals, it's like a huge pain in the ass.
So. Right. Yeah.
So what about the difference between like a bid and a proposal and an estimate? How do those things sort of work?
This is something that we talk about a lot internally and have kind of that I've been on the fence about for many years. We almost never do a bid on a project. Almost all of our billing is typically not even day-based, which is how many engineering companies will do it, but tends to be hourly-based. And to that end, you know, we keep super detailed time records, and you know, all of the time tracking kind of automatically feeds into invoicing, and clients can look at it and whatnot and see where they're at. But what that means is that when a client signs up with us, most of the time they're agreeing to a cost that's based on the estimate and that's billed hourly. That can lead to some interesting discussions with clients where, you know, a client says, well, I handed you this one-page brief that I wrote. Doesn't it spell out exactly what you're going to build for me? And you know, we're saying, well, we're building you a six-figure piece of software. No, it doesn't come anywhere close to that. So there's a lot of education about, you know, what it's like to work in an agile way, what it's like to figure out requirements as you go. And a lot of the time, you know, the way I address that is just by having that early conversation with them, in which I explain that in my view, when we're working under a fixed cost, everyone's incentives are kind of poorly aligned. Like mm-hmm. the client is incentivized to get as much as they can out of that and constantly push scope. And we're incentivized to resist all scope changes and to say, you know, what you wanted on day one of this project is what you're going to get. And there aren't opportunities to respond to like our changing understanding of what we're building over the course of the project. Mm-hmm. And none of that leads to a good outcome
yeah.
most of the time.
Yeah, we actually had a lot of trouble with that with a client recently where the scope kept on kind of changing. We were discovering things as we were building the website and certain functionality wasn't even revealed till the end. And he kept on getting more and more frustrated with us. And we were kept on trying to explain like, this is how programming works. Like you don't always know what's going to happen at the end.
Yeah, for sure. I think the way to pitch it is to say, you know, this fluid relationship or this kind of like agile approach, not just to what we're building, but to how we charge you for it and what the bill is going to be, what the cost is ultimately really enabling for everyone. I mean, it lets you see what we're doing and say, hey, that's not what I meant. Let's change course without having to do a bunch of, you know, change request paperwork and have those uncomfortable discussions.
So, but you do sort of give a ballpark figure.
Have to, right? Yeah. It can't be a blank check, you know, and you still, in practice, it's not all that different, I think, because, you know, if we look at a project and we say this is going to cost $100,000 to build and we get to the end and it's, well, we need another $10,000, like we're probably going to eat it. We're probably going to eat the cost and just finish it unless we can make a really clear case for how scope changed at some point. So it doesn't mean that the client's on the hook for any places where we went in the wrong direction and had to back up. But it does mean that over the course of the project, we can, like, they're getting a bill every month, and that bill has all the time that was done and what the cost of that was. And they see that every single month. It's pay as you go versus here's your, you know, 50% upfront deposit. We'll check back in on billing halfway through the project or whatever, you know?
Right.
So I like it because you get away from those big billing milestones, mm-hmm. which also makes it easier in some ways to manage the agency because you have this kind of constant monthly revenue coming in.
You mentioned agile. So does that mean that your programmers are primarily working on one project at a time?
It does not. It depends. It depends on like what we have going on. But typically in a given month, you know, we're billing 30 different clients probably. And we're a team of, you know, 11, 12 people. So everyone's working on a couple different things. What it does mean though that like, and I guess if you're going to talk about agile, like I'd say we're like little A agile and not big A agile. Because agile's really gotten corrupted over the last couple of years too, and has become its own set of problems. Right. But yeah, you know, we plan sprints on a weekly basis. There's a lot of communication. We tend to emphasize what we're building rather than the documentation of what we're building. We follow like a lot of continuous integration practices. So work gets done, it gets committed, it gets automatically deployed. The client's looking at it from day one on a staging server and looking at it every day, and changes are going out automatically. So we get away from like acceptance around big milestones and have it be a kind of ongoing thing. And so I think we embrace the spirit of agile.
Do you ever find that giving that sort of access to your client sort of invites them to jump ahead and start sort of saying, how come this doesn't work the way I want it to?
It does. And that's just like a client education problem,
right?
You know, you just explain to them, well, it's underway, and some days it'll be broken altogether if our test didn't catch whatever broke it. So that's just part of educating them. And most of them get it, and the ones who don't typically just aren't a great fit for us in the long run.
Yeah, I know that scope creep and sort of setting expectations on development projects is always a challenge for us. And it's always an educational experience. And it's good to hear how other agencies handle it.
My sense is that most agencies, and especially most agencies that are bigger than us, do not bill this way, and that they do tend to do fixed bids more. And so there's some, you know, I said we've talked about this internally a lot. There's always a little bit of uncertainty, like are we leaving money on the table? You know, are we not actually capturing the true value of this project by billing the way we're billing? Because, you know, when you do the idea with the big fixed bid is you put 30, 40, 50% padding in it to protect yourself. And it all kind of washes out across all the jobs. But I don't know. That approach doesn't ring true to me. And I really, estimating, billing by the hour, tracking all the time, it gives you so much data about what you're doing and where a project went wrong when it went wrong. And I think over time that really helps you to refine how you estimate the cost on projects.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I know that's something that we don't track very well and probably could do better with, but being able to see like how much time this project took, and then when you get a similar project to be able to sort of estimate based on that is very, very valuable.
It's the hardest, like when we onboard a new person, it's one of the hardest things is to get them in the habit of tracking time. And I think, you know, because everyone feels like, well, I don't want a timer running on me. I'm a person, not a cog in this corporate machine. But it there's upsides to it. I think it really helps you to be mindful of what you're doing and how often am I shifting, you know, context? Was I really productive this day? And one thing we do is we insist on not having like compensation or internal metrics rely on that stuff. So I don't want people feeling like, oh, I didn't bill enough, so I don't get paid enough, right? You want to separate that out so people aren't incentivized to jack that billing up. But I think everyone's thinking about it a lot.
So do you basically have one hourly price that you give to everybody?
No, I mean, we do for new clients. So typically if someone comes to us, you know, tomorrow, we're going to charge them probably $145 an hour for development and a little bit less for design, depending on who's doing it. But then there's a lot of extenuating circumstances. We do a lot of work with education and nonprofit clients, and we tend to end up giving them a little bit lower rate. The clients who've been with us for 10 years, we really suck at raising our clients' rates on a regular basis.
Totally. Yeah. We have have hourly rates kind of across the board because we did start out a lot lower, and some of those legacy clients can't afford higher rates, and you don't necessarily want to just dump them, you know. They kind of grew up along with your agencies.
Yeah, and you want to be loyal to them the way they were to you if you can be.
Do you have clients on any other sort of payment methods or always hourly? Do you have sort of retainers or like do you have maintenance contracts that you're doing with people?
We do. Those tend to be smaller. I mean, we will have contracts where it's like a couple $1,000s a month maybe for support and maintenance. More and more, I'm finding that clients are just prepaying these large lump sums, which we're then kind of working against, presenting some interesting accounting problems at the end of the year. But yeah, so that's what we're seeing a lot of. And then there's just a lot of clients where, you know, they have a budget. They budget, you know, X thousand dollars per quarter for us. We know what it is. We don't exceed it. We used to get revenue from hosting, but it was never more than like 5% of our total revenue. And this last year, we ended up just shutting all that part of the business down, which was a decision that was long overdue.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we do host our clients, and it's been one of those things also that like we have everybody is hosting at a different price. People are, you know, we have VPS and then we also have shared hosting, and we've been trying to consolidate that and try to, I don't know if we know how profitable it is, because a lot of times people get hosting and they think that they are getting support. Yeah. So then they call us up and they're like, hey, like, aren't we paying for you guys to help us every time something breaks down? And we're like, no.
It's a hard thing to explain, the difference between like, you know, what your $10 a month or whatever gets you. Yeah. And like real consulting time, which is rather expensive. When we started hosting, I thought it was important because it was a way to just maintain a relationship with the client. It's hard to switch hosts. But over time, I came to see it as hosting also fails a lot, and there's upstream providers involved, and it can fail for reasons that I have no control over, and it can look like it's my failure or my company's failure. Right. And I came to think that because there was almost no profit margin on it, you know, yeah, whatever relationship benefits it offered weren't worth it.
Mm-hmm. We can talk a little bit about process. Do you start with a new client with a sort of a defined discovery process?
Probably not as defined as it ought to be. We have kind of a menu of things we do, and then depending on the client and how much money is budgeted for discovery, we'll kind of pick and choose from among those. You know, we'll do environment studies, you know, figure out wherever what we're building fits into their larger online presence. We'll do, in some cases, personas, especially if it's more like informational or marketing driven, or there's complexity around who's going to be using it. Sometimes if it's a more technical or more functional project, we'll try to make like a glossary document or some way of creating like a shared language for us and the client. That's often really important. Kind of comes out of like domain-driven design principles, this idea that projects fail because people aren't speaking the same language. So we'll try to codify that a little bit.
That's cool. I've never thought about that. I mean, when one person is calling something a portal and someone else is, yeah, calling it like a landing page or a splash page or whatever. Yeah.
And that stuff can, I mean, that can cause problems throughout a project, right? Like once you get into coding and you're modeling stuff, you know, not just making templates, but writing actual functional models in code, and it has a different name than what the client's calling it, you know, the repercussions of that can be wide ranging. Yeah, that's a key part of our process for sure. What else do we do? Sitemaps. Sometimes we'll do page flows. You know, lately we've been doing like mobile first wireframes to get them to reduce that list of like 50 things they want a page to do to like 3 things so that we have something to work with.
That's nice. What do you use to do the wireframing?
That depends entirely on which design person we're working with. You know, it's been Illustrator for a long time, but now it's, you know, I think they're still building in Illustrator, but putting it up in InVision or Marvel to look over it with the client. My goal is to always kind of minimize the artifacts that we produce during discovery because they're costly and time consuming to produce. So when we come into a project, I try to look at it closely and figure out like which of these different artifacts I've mentioned are most useful, and then try to develop those.
And then since you're sort of building some of these things on the go, do you come in later in the process and sort of show wireframing? Like if you're like, okay, we maybe didn't nail this the first time, or once it hits development, does it sort of stay in development?
It typically will stay, unless there's a real like intractable problem or something that we really need to think through carefully. It's usually will get worked out in code. And these days it's getting harder and harder, I think, to communicate to clients what you're going to build in a static wireframe, you know. And you see more and more of these wireframing tools that are about, like, the wireframe itself is responsive, or you can click through it. On some projects lately, we've been having UX people who want to prototype in HTML, which, you know, to my mind still feels costly, but, you know, we have Bootstrap now, and you don't even really have to know all that much to throw together a prototype.
Yeah, we've been having that conversation sort of about what wireframe should be, because very often we do wireframing just for desktop. And yeah, that gets clients thinking a certain way, you know, and then they're not thinking about mobile until we show them mobile mockups, and they're like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah. you end up committing to stuff on the desktop side that can be quite challenging to implement on the mobile side.
Do people at Cast Iron have sort of different roles, or is everybody sort of a coder?
It's all coders and one office manager. And the coders are kind of roughly divided into front end and back end people, but that's a distinction that is increasingly breaking down, I think. But yeah, we're totally like all developers, no project managers, although I fulfill that role a lot, no account people. It's up to everybody there. And so what that means is that if you're a developer at Cast Iron Coding, you can't just be the guy who sits at his desk typing all day. You're going to have to talk to clients, and you're going to even sometimes get involved in making a sale or pushing a client towards some new work that maybe they should be thinking about.
Do you find it's difficult to find developers who have that dual skill set?
I mean, it's difficult to find developers who are good developers, let alone ones who can do other stuff. So, you know, to that end, we end up hiring a lot of people early in their career, and try to have a really strong like mentorship program, you know, where they're working closely with people, there's pair programming, there's all these kind of processes and expectations in place that they can kind of come into and learn from. It's usually like we're looking at a year at least before a new developer is really ready to be doing high quality client work.
What about project management software? Do you use any other sort of project management software?
We use Basecamp
Basecamp.
And have forever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basecamp's super important, I think, to how we work, you know, because like our clients are almost never here in Portland. They're almost always remote. And so we try to keep all kind of long form communication on Basecamp. And increasingly we're setting up Slack channels for clients and finding that clients are actually willing to go in there and communicate with us there, which is super ideal. That's kind of like where Cast Iron Coding lives and breathes, is in our Slack channel. We don't talk to each other very much at work, but we talk constantly in our chat room.
That's so funny. Copious also does that with their clients, yeah. Or they invite them to Slack channels. That was the first time I'd heard of an agency doing that. It's interesting. I suppose it has benefits and also some downsides of having people being basically IMing you.
Well, we set up two. We have an internal channel and then the client-facing one, typically.
Right.
But yeah, they rarely abuse it. And it's actually easier than getting emails, you know, because you can just deal with it there.
And it keeps track of everything in one channel, so all the information is there. Which is very important. I know that we have, since we all have different email addresses and we all have separate correspondences with all our clients, the conversations are sort of scattered everywhere in this digital universe.
Yeah, and as you get to that 10-person point you mentioned, that's where it gets really tricky when you know, client A is talking to employee A and no one knows what anyone else is doing.
Well, maybe we'll have to start setting up those Slack channels. Do you use like a CRM?
No, we don't. We use Xero for accounting. We finally made the leap from QuickBooks a couple years back. And we kind of use that as like lightweight CRM, you know, client data goes in there, and if we need it, we pull it out of there.
And do you like Xero better than QuickBooks?
Oh, yes.
Did you use QuickBooks Online?
We did not.
You just used the...
Yeah. Okay. I think we had like Windows QuickBooks running in a VM on a Mac desktop like that only one person could access. But Xero's been so great because we can, you know, we can use Xero's APIs, hook them up to Harvest APIs, and we use Harvest for time tracking, mm-hmm. and just like shoot information across those two services to generate all of our invoices. So it's reduced the time it takes us to do our billing by a day or two, probably each month.
That's great. That's awesome. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah, this was fun.
Really good information. I was wondering if you had three takeaways that you could maybe offer someone else who might be starting a coding or creative agency. What sort of advice might you give someone?
All right, let me think for a second. So number one, these are my three pieces of advice. Number one, embrace the change that happens in the industry, especially if you're in engineering. You know, there's all this talk of how it changes too fast and it's hard to keep up and blah, 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 but it's all garbage. You should see the change, embrace it, learn something new constantly, and push your employees to do the same thing. I think that's hugely important. Second thing is, as with anything in life, like, just try to ignore the hype and be honest and straightforward with the people you work with and the people you work for. There's a lot of smoke in this industry, and I think clients respond really, really well to somebody who is honest and straightforward and who listens to them and is invested in whatever problem they're trying to solve. I think that goes a long way. And three, you know, the other big challenge you'll face as an agency owner is how you deal with the people who work for you. You know, treat them the way you want to be treated. Treat them with kindness and respect, and they're the heart and soul of your business, and they'll reward you for it.
That's great. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining the podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course.